Welcome to Frenzy on the Podcast, right here on Movie City News. I'm Noah Forrest, and I will be the captain of this ship. As usual, all of your e-cards and death threats can be sent to noah@moviecitynews.com. I'm really excited for today's show because we're going to talk to the super talented Brad Anderson, director of Next Stop Wonderland, Happy Accidents, The Machinist, and Session 9, which is one of my favorite horror films of recent years. His new movie is Trans-Siberian, which I wrote about affectionately in my column. It's a Hitchcockian thriller about an American husband and wife who take the Trans-Siberian Railroad from Beijing to Moscow. While on the train, they meet another, more mysterious couple that may or may not have something to hide. A lot of what makes Trans-Siberian work so well is the level of tension that Anderson slowly ratchets up, each scene and each line contributing to the overall sense of foreboding. It's a film based on the simple premise of feeling trapped by your relationship, by your surroundings, or, very literally, by being on a train in the middle of nowhere. And the film is about what people can do when they feel trapped. It's a terrific movie. Now, let's talk to Brad Anderson. Yeah, so I saw Trans-Siberian. I was a really big fan of it. And I've been a fan of most of your films, actually. What I really wanted to talk about first, if you don't mind, is it's a little bit about Alfred Hitchcock, since, you know, Trans-Siberian is very much a Hitchcockian kind of thriller. And I was just curious, you know, which Hitchcock films did you, you know, watch in preparation? Which ones did you have in mind? I mean, besides the obvious Strangers on a Train or something like that.
I don't think we watched anything specific, you know, as we were, you know, writing the script or thinking about the story. I mean,
right.
Excuse me. I've always been, you know, a big fan of Hitchcock and most of his films, particularly the, you know, the great ones from the 30s and 40s. Yes, Hitchcock. I've always loved his movies. And my movie, The Machinist, the one I did before this, was, mm-hmm. you know, we also were very much thinking about Hitchcock, you know, when we made that film, in terms of just the general tone of it and the suspense level, and also with this one. But I mean, nothing specific. You know, I think there wasn't anything that we specifically were kind of targeting outside of the train aspect of it. I mean, all those great train movies that he made, like in North by Northwest, Lady Vanishes, Strangers on a Train, others like that. We both, Will Conroy, my co-writer, and I really loved those movies, and, you know, in some ways, you know, didn't consciously maybe, but loved the idea of kind of working in that genre again, you know, kind of bringing it back a little bit, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the great things about it, you know, the whole idea of setting it on a train in the middle of nowhere is that, you know, it really, the claustrophobia really comes through, because even when you get off this train, you're still kind of trapped.
Totally. Well, that was you know, it's one of the last real remote kind of train journeys like that on the planet. And when I took it back in 1988, that kind of became the inspiration for this movie.
Yeah.
And what struck me most of all was just the fact that you're basically one of the most remote places you can get to, or can't get to, and you know, when you combine the kind of the claustrophobia of a train with the vast open wilderness of the tundra that you're going through, it's just a great visual metaphor, and, you know, not to make too big of a thing about it, but the idea of just sort of going into this sort of empty wilderness, and even if you were able to get off the train to escape whatever's after you, there's no place to go. You can't hide anywhere, yeah?
Absolutely.
So I love that, the exoticness of it. I mean, you couldn't have done it on the Metro North between, you know, Boston and D.C., you know? It just wouldn't have had the same vibe. It had to be like a kind of exotic adventure story in a way, partly, so.
Right. And, yeah, going back to the Hitchcock thing for a second, you know, I was wondering if it was a conscious decision, since you were making kind of a Hitchcockian thriller, not to shoot the movie like Hitchcock would have, because it doesn't look anything like a Hitchcock movie.
No.
like visually.
Well, again, we weren't trying to do any kind of homage or anything to Hitchcock. We chose the sort of look and the feel just because we were going for something. We were going for a certain level of realism. I mean, Hitchcock's films, just because of when he made them and this, you know, the style, his particular style, were always very meticulously thought out and very crafted. We wanted to do something a little bit more loose, a little bit more documentary, or a lot more, I should say, and keep it like, you know, try to give the audience a little bit of the sense of the experience of being on that train, the rumble of the train, the shakiness of it, the kind of dirtiness of it, and the claustrophobic quality of being in these little cars and everything. So, yeah, I don't think anyone would ever be so bold as to try to emulate Hitchcock anyhow. right. The guy was a master of knowing where to put the camera. We were just kind of trying to capture the sense of realism, I guess, or trying to create the sense of realism for the train trip.
Right. Well, it's beautifully shot. I mean, it's not shot like a Hitchcock film, but it's still, you know, it's still amazingly well shot. That was something I really noticed. But yeah, and, you know, to me, you know, Emily Mortimer was kind of like a revelation in this. You know, I think she's always been great, but she just really commanded the screen in this movie, you know, and, you know, how much credit should I be giving her and how much credit should I give you for coaxing that performance from her?
Well, I think that's always the, you know, the chicken and the egg question regarding,
right.
I mean, you know, I don't take much of that credit. Only in being smart enough to cast her.
Right.
She wasn't our original choice, oddly enough. We had cast another actress. I mean, she was always in the top group, but we had cast someone else, and that person dropped out. They had an accident 2 days before we were supposed to start shooting and couldn't do the movie. So, you know, in the very last minute, literally, we got Emily, and she dropped everything and came over to be in our movie, knowing virtually nothing about it. So I have to hand it to her.
Yeah.
Just for that alone, but, you know, she's just a really, you know, I agree with you. I mean, she, most of the stuff she's done in some ways prior to this movie, she sort of plays the sweet, goofy, she plays like herself. She's so adorable, and she's really smart and funny and a little goofy. You know, she's great.
Right.
I love her as a person. But she doesn't play the kind of, so much the character that in this movie, but she, you know, she's an actor. And I was very happy with what she did, because she brings a level of empathy to a role in which she's really kind of making really stupid choices, you know,
yeah.
By building lies on top of lies, and you got to kind of try to keep the audience not necessarily rooting for her, but at the very least kind of in some way not wanting her to totally, you know, get caught.
Right. Well, we do sympathize.
I mean, that's sort of what Hitchcock did too, you know. Hitchcock would often make you kind of identify with the villain. Like, you think about Psycho, you know, that, you know, but the whole, you know, in some ways, the Norman Bates character in that movie is, he makes you connect with that character. Everyone else either gets killed off in the first act, or they're just, like, really wooden, and you know, you find yourself identifying with the villain, in a way, or sympathizing with the villain.
Well, it's interesting it's interesting in that movie where Hitchcock kind of presents you with all these different possible heroes and then kills them off. I mean, you got Janet Leigh, and then you got Martin Balsam, and then you're like, oh,
yeah.
Martin Balsam's going to be the hero of this movie. Okay, cool. And then he dies.
Right.
But,
exactly. Well, we didn't, you know, we killed off a couple of our characters, but, but I think, yeah, that was very, I mean, at the time, it was very revolutionary. You know, you have a movie star in the movie, expect them to be the hero, and then they just end up getting, like, you know, axed, you know, 5 minutes into it.
Well, I think your movie kind of plays on that a little bit, because, you know, you got Woody Harrelson as as Emily Mortimer's husband in the movie, and I remember for the first, I guess, 15, 20 minutes of the movie, I'm like, all right, well, Woody's going to be, you know, like, the hero of this movie.
Yeah, he's going to be.
And,
yeah, right.
And then,
or he's going to be, like, some psycho. Well, at least the roles he's most identified with, like Natural Born Killers, he's kind of a bit of a crazy guy.
Right. And
in this movie, he's pretty straight, you know? He's pretty much the straight guy, you know?
But he's still great. You know, he's still got that energy to him, you know? He's he's such a chameleon in a lot of ways, you know, to be able to play something like Mickey Knox in Natural Born Killers, and then to go to, you know, his character in this film where he's just kind of like a really sweet guy, you know? it's kind of amazing. But one of the things I love the most about this movie is that, you know, I think the central kind of the thing that draws us to this movie is that it's basically the story of a relationship. And kind of every situation that Emily Mortimer's character goes through is kind of as a result of her being so fiercely trying to hold on fiercely to her independence, I guess. And how, you know, her lies and stuff kind of hurt her relationship and then hurt her physically as well, or hurt people she loves physically.
Yeah.
And I thought that was pretty great.
Yeah, I think there's definitely, I mean, it is a story of a relationship in a way, and you know, that's sort of a failing relationship at the beginning of our story, and I think the way you put it, that she's trying to kind of cling on to her independence, isn't quite ready to relinquish herself completely to her marriage to this guy. He wants to have kids. She's not sure.
Mm.
And so that's the thing which gets her into her predicament in a way. And by the end of it, she's sort of forced to rely on her husband, who's sort of the least likely hero in a way. He becomes kind of, I mean, he doesn't necessarily succeed, but he makes an effort to kind of save them in a way. And maybe that allows her to see a level, an aspect of his character that she hadn't seen before. So it's almost like, you know, by putting your relationship under such duress and making it, and putting your relationship into such a difficult scenario, you kind of see aspects of your partner that you didn't see before. Maybe it bonds you together in a way that you hadn't suspected or expected. So by the end of the story, I mean, you know, I don't know if it's necessarily that these guys are going to go off and live happily ever after, but maybe they've discovered something about each other that can sustain them, you know? I mean, in some weird way, like now she has to live with this, this dirty secret, this dark secret, and in doing so, maybe it adds a weird level. And Woody's character is sort of aware in some way. He knows that there's something she's not telling him, but he's almost like doesn't want to know.
Yeah.
And maybe that in some way injects a level of romance into their relationship they didn't have before. I don't know.
Yeah. Well,
you know,
I think that
that's sort of interesting.
I think that scene, there's that one particular scene. I don't want to ruin it for anyone who hasn't seen it, but there's that one particular scene where the enormity of her lies kind of comes out, and you could see him getting more and more kind of upset with the fact that it's just lie after lie after lie. And I think in that moment was kind of seems like a turning point in their relationship. Like, you know, is he ever going to be able to trust her again? And at that point,
right,
it doesn't really matter. But But
yeah, I mean, I think that he's in some ways he's a very naive character, and
mm-hmm.
but in some ways, by the end of it, he's sort of smart enough to know not there's certain questions that maybe just he shouldn't even ask or try to know about.
Right.
Sometimes ignorance is bliss. I don't know, and even in a relationship, that's, you know, and they don't know everything about each other. But the one thing you can say about Woody's character is that he's a man who truly, you know, he genuinely loves this woman, and, you know, whether it's a goofy kind of, like, love or whatever, I mean, I don't think it's insincere. I mean, he's the most self-effacing character and sincere character in the movie. Everyone else is, like, harboring some lie.
Absolutely.
Or some dirty secret. And, like, so it's...
He's, like, the only normal man in the
end of it,
world, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's when we were writing it, we were definitely going for that, you know, to create these characters that were, as we were kind of described it, as they're kind of like those nesting dolls, those Matryoshka dolls, you know? It's like you peel off one layer and there's another one inside, and maybe even if you dig deep enough, you'll find some, like, drug or something bad inside them, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Everyone's got something. Everyone has, on the outside they might be this beautiful thing, but inside there might be something dark and scary. Yeah. And, you know,
and I think that's been a theme for you, over the last couple movies, you know, is this kind of, this dark thing inside of a lot of people. I mean, you know, going to Session 9 or The Machinist.
Yeah, you're right. That is. I mean,
even in your Fear Itself episode with Eric Roberts, you know.
Yeah, you're right, definitely. No, I mean, that is, I guess that's something that interests me, or at least I've been drawn to. I don't know why, but just, I think characters that have some darker, dark interior, you know, what it allows you to do dramatically is have that scene towards the end in which they receive themselves for who they truly are, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, you know, in The Machinist, there's that moment at the end where he realizes he's a killer, he killed his boy. In Session 9, it's almost a similar way. You could say the same thing about the Fear Itself episode. And yeah, I don't know why. I guess it's some strange little fascination of mine.
Is there anything you want to get off your chest? I mean...
Yeah, right. I don't think I have any secrets myself, necessarily, on that level. But yeah, at least the past few films. I mean, my first couple movies were more romantic comedies and very different. But yeah, the past several films... Or at least things have been very much like that. It's an interesting point.
Well, you know, like you said, your first two films were romantic comedies, and now you've done a kind of couple of thrillers and a horror film. Do you feel more connected to one genre or the other, or do you like skipping around?
I kind of prefer skipping around a little bit, like not being tied to any one particular genre. I mean, as a director, I really enjoy experimenting with different genres because it's like anything. You kind of want to test yourself, see if you can do that kind of a story. Or, you know, it also allows you to use different techniques cinematically, you know? I mean, you know, The Machinist was a very different looking movie than this movie I just did.
Right.
I mean, I always want to kind of... I don't, you know, maybe to the detriment of my career, I for some reason, I'm more interested not in branding myself and becoming the guy who does this kind of movie. I'd rather be the guy who does different kinds of movies and does them each interesting and well, you know what I mean?
So,
and you look at, you know, some of the people, you know, you can always tell a Hitchcock film. I mean, but you look at people like, you know, even Kubrick, you know, it's like, he always had his own particular style, but he did war movies, he did dark comedies, he did twisted romances, he did
satire,
science fiction, you know, I mean, you know, so...
Well,
I
love
you,
Kubrick.
You know.
I mean, are you a Kubrick fan as well?
Oh, totally. Like, he's probably one of my all-time... I can watch his movies endlessly. I'm just fascinated by his... Not just his stories, but just by his level of... craft. I mean, the guy was like a craftsman.
Absolutely.
Beyond belief. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, I was just rewatching Barry Lyndon recently, and every time I watch the movie, I can't get over how good it is. I mean, every single aspect of that movie is just perfect. It might be, in my opinion, one of the most perfect movies ever made, but...
It's so true, yeah, I agree 100%. The fact that, you know, how did he achieve that perfection? Designed his own lenses so he could shoot the movie under candlelight, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
The guy was, like, not just a creative genius, but technically, you know, he's one of the first guys to use Steadicam, really.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, so it's, he's amazing. And, I've always, you know, wanted to do a big science fiction movie next.
Yeah.
That would be fun.
Just
something big and epic like 2001, you know.
Is this something you're planning? Do you have a script or anything, or...?
I'm working on some ideas. I don't have a script yet, but I got some ideas I'm filling away at. But nothing set in stone yet.
Well, that's great that you want to hop around in different genres and stuff, but if you were offered the opportunity to, like, kind of direct the franchise movie, you know, would you jump at that opportunity, you think, or Would you shy away from that? Like, let's say you had the opportunity to kind of direct the Batman franchise. Is that something that you'd be interested in?
Well, I like what Chris Nolan has done with that.
Right.
You know, I just saw the new one recently, and it's great that directors with that kind of talent and vision are taking on the real typical genre type movies.
Mm-hmm.
That wouldn't really be something that interests me. I'm not that particular example, just because I don't really, not that deep into those kind of comic book movies.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would do a bigger studio movie. There's been some offers and a few, I've gotten down the road with a few of those things that just haven't panned out for usual reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But, it just really, it's always about the material. It's always about the script and if it just feels like something I could spend 2 years of my life doing, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and
I've got two kids now. There's always the the economics of it too. You got to look at, you know what I mean? You make one Scream movie, and you're set for, you know, there you go.
Yeah.
Put your kids through college. More, you know?
Yeah, but I that is refreshing to hear, you know, because I always think that, you know, when I heard that Chris Nolan was taking over the Batman franchise, I was like, well, you know, that's cool and everything, but, you know, he's such a talent, I'd love to see him do a movie that doesn't have kind of a ceiling on it, you know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, he's such a great...
But I think that's the thing he could do. I don't know what he's doing with his career, but
yeah,
obviously he could probably do anything he wants now. He could go back and do a small kind of, you know, movie that no one would ever finance, but they would because it's him, you know, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, it's more like actors, like Christian Bale, for instance. He can do Batman, but that allows him to do the next Werner Herzog movie or the next Terrence Malick film or maybe even the next Brad Anderson movie.
So that's
and you know
convenient.
he's the kind of guy who's able to make those kind of choices. And I look at someone like Soderbergh, and to me he's got a career that I admire too, because he has to do Ocean's 13, but that allows him to do a small movie like Solaris or something that five people see.
Yeah.
But he's able to take those chances. It's sort of cool, you know.
Well, the great thing about Soderbergh is...
Studio guy.
Yeah.
Through and through.
But, you know, the great thing about Soderbergh is when he does a movie like Ocean's 11 or Ocean's 12 especially, you know, he's still kind of playing with the form. You know, it's not like a completely empty experience for him, it seems.
What did you say, sir?
I was just saying, for Soderbergh, you know, doing Ocean's 11 or Ocean's 12 or even 13, it's not just an empty experience for him because he gets to play with the form a lot, you know, especially in Ocean's 12.
Oh, totally, right. I mean, even his studio movies aren't, you know, totally hack, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's still interesting. Yeah, I mean, to me, that's cool. I admire that. But right now, I'm totally content. You know, I'm surviving, doing what I'm doing. I've got a couple other projects lined up, and I'm happy to do my movies on a smaller level if it allows me to have the creative freedom that I want, latitude.
Absolutely.
And if I can get that same latitude on a bigger movie, then absolutely. I mean, I certainly want more money to make my movies. No one would.
Right, right.
You know, unless it's like a corrupting influence.
Yeah.
But in general, you know, you want to work on a level that you're not, the money doesn't become the thing that totally steers the ship, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, going back a little bit, I just wanted to talk about Session 9 for a little bit, just because to me, that's like one of the best horror movies of the last 10 years. I've shown it to kind of everyone I know. I was like, you have to watch this movie; it's so good. And I just wanted to kind of get into, you know, what the genesis for that movie was. You know, what kind of inspirations you had for that, and stuff like that.
Well, that was just I had just finished doing two kind of romantic comedies, and I wanted to do something totally different and take a U-turn. And I was just like, I wanted to go in a totally different direction. And it was really like Trans-Siberian, which was inspired by the location, the train in Russia, the Trans-Siberian train. Mm-hmm. Very much the story came out of the location. That for Section 9, it was this big abandoned mental hospital in Danvers, Massachusetts, which when I used to live up in Boston, I'd see a lot. And there's such a cool, dramatic-looking structure. It had so much history. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can just imagine, you know, the kind of scary shit that went down there. That it totally, I wrote that with a partner. The script evolved out of the location. We went there, we snuck in with some guys, and, you know, toured the place, because it was totally off limits, you know, it's like a total derelict, you know, place. And you know, in that came up with a lot of cool ideas and just put them down into a script. Just also wanted to do, that was a movie, you know, that was back in, I don't know, 2000 or something, and we wanted to do some kind of movie that was a little bit of a, we were just tired of all the stupid-ass fucking so-called horror movies, like, you know, Scream, and I Know What You Did Last Summer. But
absolutely.
That were really, like, big then, you know, it was like, they were talking about some kind of resurgence in horror, but it was really awful,
mm-hmm.
not scary, just kind of more, like, smug and shit. And we wanted to just do something that was genuinely creepy and not horror, but that's about shocking you or making you jump out of your seat, but more just kind of about creating a level of dread and a level of, like, menace and atmosphere, you know? So, yeah, we just want, that was what interested me about doing something like that, and not doing something like, because, you know, it could have certainly been the kind of story where a bunch of teenagers go into a haunted mental hospital and the beautiful one, you know, they all start dying in really awful ways. I mean, you know, but...
Yeah, it could have been...
We avoided that, you know what I mean?
It could have been that. It could have been Night of the Demon, but instead it's...
Yeah.
It's something a little bit more.
Yeah.
But yeah, that movie, you know, it still gets me every time, actually. And I think it's just because, you know, Peter Mullen, especially, is so... effectively creepy towards the end of the movie. You
know, yeah, it's sad too. It's also very tragic.
Absolutely.
That's the other thing. It's like good horror to me always comes out of there's a very thin line between good horror and like really good tragedy. You know, because it's like if you feel for the characters, then it makes their situation that much more horrific.
Absolutely.
And it makes it scarier. You know, and like Psycho as another example. Like Norman Bates' character is, you know, he's not just a wooden cutout. He's like, he's got a really great performance, and it's a great character.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, you know, all these, you know, so-called horror movies of the moment, you don't give a shit about the guys in Saw or the people in Hostel. You know, the kids are getting cut up. Who gives a shit? You know.
Absolutely.
But it's like there's no the only horror in those movies comes out of the graphic nature of the violence, you know?
Yeah.
But there's nothing sticks with you. There's no residue of horror that you leave. You don't give a shit about the people, you know? You might be a little shocked at what you see, but that's just basically porn, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like torture porn.
Yeah, that's...
But you know, good horror is like, you know, it lives with you afterwards, you know, because in some ways you identify the characters and you think whatever horror happened to them, you know, could happen to you. You know, there's a level of identification.
Well, yeah, especially Session 9. I mean, Peter Mullen's character, you know, this moment of rage is basically what kind of turns him, and it's kind of like, wow,
yeah.
Like, I've been angry
it could
before.
Happen, you can all snap.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
And I think there's a tragic element to all of your recent movies, you know, including the Fear Itself episode and the Masters of Horror episode that you did. You know, they all have kind of this element of tragedy in them, and I think that's what makes them, like you said, I mean, that's what makes you affected by it.
Yeah, I think it's good to be, you know, plus as a director, it allows you to get, you know, if you write those kind of roles that aren't just two-dimensional, you can get good actors, you know, getting something like a Peter Mullen or that sound in the Masters of Horror episode. Chris Bauer is really great, New York actor. And yeah, just like working with really good actors like that is like such a gift, you know, because it brings so much to the table. You know? And you got to have the
you gotta have the raw material there that you can just expect,
you know, otherwise you're just getting, I don't know, the usual,
yeah,
you know, latest guy from whatever hot TV show at the moment is going on.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've taken up so much of your time, but I just want to, you know, get you out of here on this one, which is kind of what I asked everybody, which is, you know, we've already talked about this a little bit, but what are, like, some of your favorite movies overall?
Well, I'd say anything by Kubrick, particularly 2001 and Paths of Glory, which is an amazing
anti-war
film. Yeah. I really like a lot of films by... well, like, you know, not to be a total highbrow about it, but I love, like, Andrei Tarkovsky's films, great Russian filmmaker, made these most very poetic, beautiful films in the 70s and 80s.
He did the original Solaris, yeah.
Or Stalker, Nostalgia, The Mirror, amazing movies, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to make a movie in Russia, because I love his movies. I love Peter Weir's films. I think he does really, he's another master of the craft. I mean, you see a movie like Master and Commander or
Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy's like, he just always has a certain soulfulness in his movies.
Even Greenbird is way better than it should be. I mean,
so I feel like the one I haven't actually seen, but I'll have to check it out sometime. But I just think he makes really interesting movies and takes you to exotic places.
Yeah.
As does Werner Herzog. I love his movies.
Mm.
Even his documentaries, I just think his early films are so, you know, you're basically there. You're like a, you know, Spanish conquistador stuck in the middle of the Amazon jungle. I mean, that kind of shit, you can't even make those kind of movies these days, you know what I mean? They wouldn't allow you. The unions wouldn't even let you get those people on a plane. I mean, so you're seeing movies that are kind of capturing a time period, like in the 70s when, like, stuff was a little more loosey-goosey.
Yeah,
I like Roman Polanski's movies, like, the same way that I like Hitchcock. Like, you know, film like The Tenant or Repulsion, which is amazing, or even his later movies, like, you know, I thought The Pianist is
a
beautiful movie. Yeah, I tend to veer more towards European directors. I don't know why, but,
well, I'm with you on that, actually, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, that's just... But there, you know, those are just generalities, you know, other ones, of course. But I'd say those are maybe some of my more favorite guys.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. And I appreciate you taking the time to finally sit down with me. So thanks again. And Trans-Siberian's expanding, right? So hopefully I'm rooting for it. So.
Thanks, man.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Good talking to you. Anyway.
Thanks for listening to Frenzy on the Podcast here on Movie City News. As always, emails can be sent to Noah@moviecitynews.com.